is Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of the eponymously named Harvell and Collins Law Firm. And by the way, I just want to remind you, please do not hesitate to make a phone call, a simple phone call, 252 area code 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Again, that spell out that word and, A-N-D, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. So we're glad to be here, and here we are. We're the middle of March. St. Patrick's Day, as you say, Lockwood. I don't think I knew that, but yeah. I know it now.
The Ides of March, as a matter of fact, yeah.
Yeah, the Ides of March, whatever. Lockwood, Wes and I and you have spoken several times about the conflict that arises in families whereby, for whatever reason, an account gets registered joint with right of survivorship, mm-hmm. payable on death, time on death. They are all of those phrases really mean, that terminology really mean the same, which is that the account does not vest in the estate of the decedent and therefore does not pass according to the last will and testament or trust. It passes according to who else is on the account, which of course is usually one of the beneficiaries, maybe the one that is taking care of the parent. But before I get off track, the bottom line is that these accounts exist. And they are out there at all of the banks and the brokerage firms, your stock companies, all of them have these registrations. And Wes is going to go into great detail about this in a moment after I do this introduction about the way in which these files get litigated. But the bottom line is, and then of course just yesterday, two brothers, one lives here, one lives in Raleigh. The will leaves everything 50-50. There is, in fact, a home in Raleigh that will be sold that will go 50-50. Mm-hmm. But guess what? One of the brothers who lives, you know, more proximate to the father had the accounts registered POD. And we thought that matter would get resolved. We're representing the brother that is not on the account, mm-hmm. and we wrote letters and had conversation with him about the dilemma that he's in with regard to the fact that these accounts got registered with these survivorship designations. Mm-hmm. And so now here we are. It's a considerable amount of money. It usually is, Lockwood. The files that we see, it's not about, you know, the $5,000 or $7,500, you know, bank account. Right. It's about, you know, the several hundred thousand dollar accounts. So with all that said, we see both sides of this, Lockwood, and it is a real dilemma that exists in our industry. And when I say our industry, I mean the investment industry, right. The banking industry, that these account registrations exist, and there's confusion about it. One more sentence. For instance, you know, daughter goes in with her mom to the bank just to say that she wants to be able to pay her bills.
Right.
And the next thing we know, the account with, you know, $180,000 in it, the banker puts it in the name of the mother and the daughter. Mm-hmm. And so when the mother dies, it goes to the daughter with a death certificate. That's not why they went into the bank.
Right.
They went into the bank just so that the daughter could pay the bills. That's right. Called a power of attorney. Mm-hmm. That doesn't change the registration of the account, nor does it change the way in which the account will be distributed when mom dies. the power of attorney simply gives the daughter the right to pay the bills off of the account. So with all this said, we are filled to the brim with cases in our office on a weekly basis that are touching and concerning this issue. And Wes, Mr. Collins, our litigator, is brought in on all of these cases, and then we kind of go from there. So Wes, that was a long introduction, but you go from there, my friend.
Well, I like long introductions because then I have to say less about it. So thank you for that. But I enjoy, you know, dealing with these issues. I don't like seeing them. I think, you know, for our listeners, this is kind of a word to the wise type situation where we're just, you know, letting them know to be cognizant of this. And the problems arise because of the way that the whole system is set up dealing with mm-hmm. how these documents are changed. And we've talked about this before, Lockwood, where, you know, when you execute a will, there is a whole body of law going into great detail with regard to the formality that mm-hmm. comes along with the ceremony of signing a will.
Mm-hmm.
As far as capacity goes, the number of witnesses, the type of witnesses, the mm-hmm. location of the witnesses, the location of the witnesses in proximity to the testator, the person who signed the will. Those are just a few items. And then there are different kinds of wills as well. So we have a whole body of law about that. But then when we get into this issue of signing change of beneficiary documents or joint account documents, and Cecil primarily was focused on bank-related documents, payable on death documents,
mm-hmm.
then our law dealing with the requirements for doing that is very thin. It's very thin. And there aren't witnesses required in most cases. Normally, the individuals who are in charge of basically the requirements are kind of entry-level mm-hmm. bank employees in many cases. I've seen cases, Lockwood, where these documents are picked up, taken to somebody, purportedly signed, delivered back to the bank. The bank accepts them. The account changes as a result of that. And, you know, who knows if the person that they were taken to actually signed them or not, or whether, or, you know, whether someone else signed their name. We really don't know. Because we don't have witnesses, we don't have a notary,
mm-hmm.
we just have a piece of paper that was taken out. You know, I've had these cases where on the surface, it certainly appears that the person changed the account and the account, you know, goes all to this one person. That seems to be quite contrary to the long standing estate plan. And like mm-hmm. Cecil said, you know, oftentimes we're dealing with hundreds of thousands of dollars here. You know, we have a handwriting expert look at the signature.
Mm-hmm.
The opinion is, yes, it's the person's signature. And then, but, you know, the medical records may indicate that the person's not in the greatest of condition.
Right, right.
May be confused, may, in many cases, I think what happens is they sign these documents because they want this individual who the account goes to at their death in total to just be able to pay bills.
Right.
Well, but they don't, they're not told that it, well, if you put, you know, your daughter or caregiver, whomever it is, on the account, you know, then upon your death, it's going to go completely to that person and not go to your other children. So there's, I think they do it in many cases without being properly advised or fully understand. But like I was saying, I've had these kind of cases where it appears as though the person has signed it. You know, the handwriting expert says, yes, they have signed it, or it's my opinion that it's likely they did. And then we kind of get into the meat of it. One case comes in mind to mind in particular, and then we learned that the bank personnel had the person sign the form before the form was ever filled out.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. And so the bank personnel in deposition says, well, I didn't put the name of who it was to go to on there because she was thinking that it was a case about that one person manipulating the mother. Well, no, it's a case about whether this is valid or not. Well, if you sign a bank document such as that to change an account, the POD or joint with right of survivorship, but when it was signed, it was blank, well, that's invalid. So we see a lot of mistakes, you know, with these documents as well. So it's largely driven by what the respective bank will accept, what their rules are with regard to having these documents signed. But really, there's just one rule, and that rule is the owner of the account has to sign the document. And that's it. No witnesses, no notary, no issues with regard to capacity, ability to be able to understand what you're doing. And so it's a matter of a document being presented that changes the account. It's then accepted, goes through the process, and then the account is changed. And then we don't learn about it until when? Until after the person has died. Because there's no real indication, there's no real indication to the family as to how any of these particular accounts will go, or whether there's been a change to the estate plan until after the person has passed away.
Talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and we're talking about the registrations on accounts. And this is an interesting conversation in the sense that in much of what you're dealing with, it's a matter of preparation. If the family is wants to avoid, or the individual wants to avoid a conflict, they need to think early on, and they need guidance on something of this nature. A quick question on this. In your capacity as a litigator, is it conceivable, and you probably are going to go here, but is it conceivable to contest a document of this nature? And if so, how do you do so in light of the fact that the benefactor is no longer there? The benefactor has died. Is it possible to contest these documents?
Absolutely. And that's kind of why Cecil was saying a few minutes ago, these files end up in Mr. Collins' lap office. You know, obviously we all work in the same place, Harvell and Collins, but, you know, I'm the head of the litigation department.
Right.
So, yes, I mean, I've had many, I don't know if it's, I mean, it's definitely dozens. I don't know if it's 100. It's probably not 100, but maybe it is. Seems like it's pretty close of files that we've dealt with, that are these kind of facts, and they're not always on the side of the document being changed based on what we believe to be a mistake or at a time of undue influence or not, you know, following formalities. It's not always us doing the challenging. Sometimes it's someone else doing the challenging and we're defending against it.
Right.
And we still have to, and we're still dealing with the same facts.
Right, right.
You know, the same circumstances, the same, you know, medical records, the same, you know, was it signed by the owner of the account or was it signed through a power of attorney? I mean, sometimes, you know, we see that the agent under the power of attorney signed it, and then, you know, we get into issues with regard to what authority you had under the power of attorney, because that would be something where you need specific language in most cases to change the account. I mean, really, really express language. And sometimes that gets done and the bank doesn't realize that that's not allowed what was done. And then they process it anyway. And then we're stuck in a position where the bank doesn't know what to do with the money upon to death because of that. So, yes, we litigate these issues here locally, you know, all across, really across the state, in different courts, and have done so with great success, you know, actually. Now, if we're dealing with a situation, Lockwood, where we learned that the account was changed to joint maybe, you know, 5 years ago or six, seven, eight, 10 years ago before the person died, mm-hmm. and then the information we're getting is that the person was in good health, was still driving, mm-hmm. was handling their own bill payment, was doing all of those things for themselves, living by themselves, cooking for themselves, going to activities themselves, going to church by themselves or with friends or what whomever, right. It may be, with whomever it may be, then we're going to really think twice before we go into challenging the validity of this type of change. Mm-hmm. We're going to do that. But the cases, it seems to be that that most of these cases end up being a situation where the person is not in good shape. They're cognitively have declined. Mm-hmm. They're not handling their own affairs. They're not driving anymore. And the document is signed not too far before the person has passed away.
Right.
And I think that the majority of those cases are like that for a couple reasons. I think that if, someone kind of has their wherewithal and understands that they're being taken to a bank or they're going to a bank for purposes of making a change to their account that's been the same way for years, if they've kind of got it together, they're probably going to ask the right questions. Mm-hmm. They're probably going to say, is this, how does this change where the account goes
right.
when I pass away? Those kind of things. But when they become more feeble and more concerned about things like someone paying their bills, then I think folks in that station in life are much less likely to dig into how questions regarding how is this going to affect where the account goes when I die.
Right, right.
And then the bank personnel, I think a lot of times, I think they feel like that they're not really supposed to give advice on this. They're just saying, well, if you want your daughter to be able to pay the account or pay your bills, we can just make it joint. And that's as much as is said. Mm. I think there's some of that happens. Where obviously if, the better way to do that is to have a power of attorney in place, a proper power of attorney, giving your daughter, for example, your whomever it may be, the authority to be able to pay your bills for you.
Right.
And then that doesn't alter your estate plan, alter your accounts that have been probably longstanding set up in the way that they've been set up for years and gives the authority to someone to pay your bills, which is what you're in many cases trying to accomplish, as opposed to upsetting your longstanding estate plan.
Right.
So, I just think the circumstances when someone gets of a more advanced age lend itself to these type of mistakes being made. Because folks are just, it's kind of obvious. I'm stating the obvious because they're just don't know what questions to ask. They don't care to ask the questions. They're more concerned about their electric bill getting paid, mm-hmm. And in many cases, it could be that the person who is taking them to the bank, for example, or putting the document in front of them has some nefarious intent and wanting to get that account to go to them upon death. And then they're being deceptive in the way they're going about doing it. Oh, Mom, don't worry, this will let me take care of your bills. You don't worry about it. And I think there are even conversations, Lockwood, where I mean, this happens. I know it happens, but it happens in a, you know, kind of behind a closed door, where the person who is attempting to kind of take advantage of the situation is saying things to the parent like, "Oh, Mom, don't worry about how everything goes. I'm going to make sure everything goes right. equally."
Yes, yeah.
Oh, I think that happens a lot. And then the people end up signing whatever with trust, and then there's a little bit of that, "Well, my daughter's taking care of me, and I don't have anybody else to. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I trust her, and I want, even if she gets some more, I'm okay with it." You know, there's some of that, like, kind of maybe a little bit of a guilt thing, a little mm-hmm. bit.
Right.
But then I see it pretty often where you know, the assets do go, you know, to the child with some nefarious intent, and then that promise to share everything equally and divide it equally is then forgotten.
Right. Never was said, actually.
Never was said.
This also leads to the issue of proximity. In other words, you have one family member who is nearby, and of course, by nature of just proximity, has greater influence in the circumstance, and that is a problem as well. The other aspect of this, and I'm thinking Wes, and again, Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins with us this afternoon. We're talking about the issue of registration of accounts. You know, the other situation is that in the process of these accounts, I think a lot of the benefactors, the individuals who are the principals of the accounts, the parents, for example, are looking for the easiest, simplest way out. But in reality, upon their death, it becomes the most complicated and, unfortunately, most costly factor, does it not?
Yes. Elderly folks, they more and more and more, as they advance in age, want to take the path of least resistance.
Right.
That becomes more and more important to them as they advance in age. I see it all the time. They don't want conflict. Mm-hmm. They want to get along with everybody.
Right.
And they just don't want to ask the hard questions mm-hmm. about things. And the daughter or the son or whoever who is in more close proximity is probably the one that they have to answer to and talk to more
right.
often.
Right.
And that may be the one who's attempting to take advantage of the situation. And maybe that's the one who is checking in on them or uh-huh. bringing them food by or right. driving them to wherever they need to go. And so they just want to keep everything peachy keen.
Right.
And 5 years prior, they probably would not allow some of the stuff to happen because the path of least resistance is less important to them. Doing things properly in the way that they have had them set up was more important. So, yes, I agree with that.
And then in the midst of all of this becomes a very contentious issue upon their death, and something I'm confident many of these the deceased does not interested in leaving the family with is those contentious situations. A real quick question on the responsibility of the institutions involved, the banks, the insurance companies, and or the financial institutions. Do they have any accountability? Is there any responsibility on their part?
Yes, there can be.
Wow.
There absolutely can be. If the circumstances are not proper, they didn't process the document properly, or they did like what I described to you just a minute ago,
yeah,
where they put the document in front of the customer and had it signed and then filled it out. I mean, absolutely there can be liability with regard to them. Now, what banking institutions, insurance companies that have that are annuity companies, you know, what they like to do if there's the potential for the issue to be contested as far as where the assets are to pass,
mm-hmm.
they like to interplead those funds, which is smart. What they want to do is they want to deposit them with the court. under our statutes regarding interpleader.
Okay.
And they deposit them with the court. They then seek an order releasing them from liability as to those assets. And then they let the parties who are in dispute regarding the assets fight it out. And then they're out of it.
Okay.
And then the assets are dispersed consistent with the final order of the court on that issue. Because in the event that the institution, financial institution, pays out under circumstances that are questionable, then they may find themselves as a defendant in a lawsuit, thereby bringing upon themselves legal fees to defend themselves.
Right.
And if things don't go the way that are consistent with the disbursement, then they may be ordered to pay the money out again. And that's from their own coffers.
Wow.
So interpleader is a nice tool that we deal with fairly frequently in these contested matters that is keeps things efficient, takes the financial institution out of the fray, allows them to do what they do, which is banking or insurance or whatever it may be, and not being broiled in litigation, and then provides a clean mechanism for getting to the bottom of the legal issue with regard to the validity of whatever's being contested, such as the beneficiary designation, joint account designation, whatever it may be. And then we're in a position at the end of that where we're not getting a judgment against someone who got the money that we have to collect. The money is there with the court, and therefore the court then disperses the money consistent with the order of the court.
Okay.
So,
That leads to a question
Lockwood, I think that one way to kind of sum all of this up is these circumstances are what I call kind of the perfect storm. Let's talk for a minute about, say, a life insurance policy.
Right.
Hey, Cecil, at this point right here, let's make a point.
Okay.
Yes.
If there is any question about this, upon the death of someone, it is as important as it can be, Lockwood, to seek legal counsel immediately. And you know why? Because once that money is paid out,
it's gone.
Sometimes it's hard to get it back.
Okay.
I'm dealing with a case right now where it was a litigation case. Actually, it was an estate administration matter that Cecil was handling. The executor of the estate brought up the fact that some annuity accounts were changed right before the death.
Ooh.
So he did the right thing. He got on the phone and called the annuity companies and sent a letter to them immediately, like fax, email, immediate. And what did they do? They froze the account. They did not disperse out the money. The money was then interpleaded into the court. And so he handled it before the money got out to this person who we think was acting nefariously.
Wow.
So this is definitely one of those areas where you need to act fast. Now, I will contrast that with, you know, if someone passes away and you need to handle their estate, we don't necessarily tell folks, be there on day,
right,
the next day. I mean, you know, you grieving process, be with the family,
right,
so on and so forth. It might take a week or two or three to get in with the attorney. This is the kind of thing where waiting could end up being a huge mistake. You have to act. This is one of those deals that when it's presented to us at a meeting in our office, the first question is, has the money been paid out yet?
Wow.
Oftentimes the client says, I don't know. They won't tell me anything. And so we, in many cases, even during the appointment or immediately after the appointment, we are making the phone calls and trying to freeze those funds. Okay. So expediency is a number one in this type situation. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
No, you didn't. Yeah, that's an excellent point. And then what I was going to say in conclusion, Lockwood, is just these circumstances are kind of what I call the perfect storm.
Uh-huh.
You know, let's for a minute look at like a life insurance policy or even an annuity.
Uh-huh.
These policies, the client is asked point blank, the decedent, who do you want your beneficiary to be?
Uh-huh.
They have to write down the names of the children, okay? That's so very different than an account at a bank or a stock company
uh-huh.
just getting registered with a child.
Uh-huh.
The questions just don't get asked. You know, it's all about who's asking the question
mm-hmm.
and how is the question being explained to the client, quote, the decedent. How are they understanding what they're signing? In these situations, the reason I call it the perfect storm is because the one child is maybe proximate to the elder person.
Right.
They don't really understand what they're signing. It might even be that the child doesn't particularly understand it completely.
Uh-huh.
But this is what the bank, this is what, you know, the stock company said we need to do, Mom. So that I, and then here comes the big ingredient, so I can pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a life insurance doesn't have that comment, so I can pay the bills, or an annuity with a beneficiary, so I can pay the bills. But a bank account or a stock account or a money market account, you know, the elder person knows that those that liquidity is there to take care of them in their elder age. So the perfect facts are there for the banker and or the stock company to say, well, this will allow your daughter to pay the bills. Well, needless does the daughter know, needless does the principal know that, well, but by the way, when we die, that account goes exactly to the, exclusively to the one child. So the perfect ingredients are there for there to be an accident. And then I love your point, Lockwood, that you made. I'm very sympathetic to it. You know, the next thing we know, we're having to hire lawyers
right.
for thousands and thousands of dollars to do something about this. That, of course, was never, ever what the principal, the elder person, wanted to happen. That's the very opposite of what they wanted to happen. And so there we go.
And also the loss of time and things of this nature. And one other comment real quickly. I think quite often, Cecil, Wes, we go to these institutions, banks, financial institutions, insurance companies, with the expectations that they have all of this legal concept in mind, that they are working as you're working, but they aren't. They're working for their company, which they should, and they're just focused on one aspect. I'm selling your services, yes, because what I'm saying here is that third party, which is what we're talking with here, is that of the attorney firm, the firm of Harvell and Collins, has that responsibility to look at the entire picture, not just one aspect of it. But we assume as the customers that the institutions we're going to, the banks, the financial institutions, that they are seeing this, if you will, holistically, the whole picture. But they aren't. They're looking just at their specific responsibility. So that is, we didn't get into this, but that is one of the benefits and the purposes of such things as, estate planning and also powers of attorney. This is one of those things that so often we want to work around, but in fact, what we end up doing is we go deeper into a hole than if we just simply ask a simple question. That's my conclusion. Would you agree to that?
Yes, that's an excellent conclusion. You know, like for instance, we review these accounts in our estate planning
mm-hmm, right.
conferences. We will ask the client, we don't have to have this initially, all we need is you, the client, in our office.
Mm-hmm.
But through the process, we will gather your account statements. And if we see that, you know, a stock statement at A.G. Edwards, Edward Jones, you know, Wells Fargo Investments, whatever, is POD different than the last will and testament, then, of course, or the trust, we then begin to have conversation about that with the client. So
So we're doing, you know, we're the right hand and the left hand. Let's get coordinated here. Right. Let's not have the will leave everything 50-50, but the accounts are registered exclusively with one child. Something's off there.
Yes.
There's a problem about to happen. And yeah. So the planning process that we lawyers do would potentially, almost most likely, discern that problem, find out, discover that problem.
All the more reason why I continue to mention this. Make that phone call, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. Or as I mentioned, go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com.